This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
What is it all about? Arguments, the differences of opinion among people. What causes them, and how are they to be handled? Among religious Jews, there can only be one of three types of machlokas, only one of three types of disputes and differences of opinion, disagreements. The first one is where the other person has done nothing wrong, you just don't like him. That's common to all of humanity, that you can have that kind of machlokas. The guy gets on your nerves. Why? Has he done anything wrong? No. Is he particularly wicked? No. Can you put your finger to anything that he's responsible for? No, you don't like his face, you don't like the way he does A, B, C, whatever it is, it makes no difference. But the important thing is he's done nothing wrong, but nevertheless you can't stand him. There's such a concept. A second kind of machlokas is a machlokas in halacha. That means we both believe in the same basic principles. I believe that it is in keeping with those principles to do A, B, C, D, and he believes it's not in keeping with those principles to do A, B, C, D. It's a machlokas. And the third kind is where I believe the other person is a rosha. I believe he's wicked. That's it. It's not that I don't like him although he's done nothing wrong. It's not that we have a halachic dispute. There is no communication at all. In the first case, there's no communication because he's done nothing wrong. In the second case, there's communication and disagreement. In the third case, there's also no communication. He's a rosha. I've got nothing to talk to him about. There's no communication. I don't like him, and that's the cause of the machlokas. Those are the only three types of machlokas that there can exist among religious Jews. And among anybody else, there's only one kind of machlokas that can exist, and that's really the first kind. Because you have no objective frame of reference to decide that a person's a rosha, if you're not a religious Jew, nor do you have any objective frame of reference to decide that you're having an academic dispute. You think this A and you think it's B. If you don't have a Torah Shebaal Peh, if you don't have a system of reasoning, if you don't have a mathematics, if you don't have in religion and philosophy the equivalent of mathematics, that is, a precise, organized system of reasoning, then there's no way that you can have any dispute other than a personal one. So whether it's Buddhism or it's Christianity or it's hedonism or it's anything. Once there's no Torah Shebaal Peh, as there isn't with any other religion, it's all a matter of opinion. This is your opinion, that's my opinion. And opinion is no basis to have an argument. Because your opinion is no more valid whatever than the other man's opinion, and the other man's opinion is no more or less valid than your opinion. Opinions, by virtue of their very definition, are not valid at all. Two laymen having an argument about what's the cause of heart disease. You can't make bad friends because you have different opinions from one another. Two doctors having an argument can, because they're having a basic academic dispute. And a doctor is having an argument with a colleague doctor who says, I don't care about heart attacks, let the patients die, I haven't got time to worry about that. He's a rosha. That's also a basis for an argument. But unless you have a science, there's only one argument, and that's the first. In the Torah so far, from Bereshis, as far as I can see, we've had three arguments. We've had three machlokas. The first one was Cain and Hevel. It's right in the opening stories of the Torah. We are introduced to the first machlokas, to the first difference of opinion between people. The difference of opinion was between Cain and his brother Hevel. Where would you classify that one? Which one of the three would that be? Must be the first. There's no basis for the argument. There's no halakhic dispute they're having. Cain got jealous of Hevel because Hevel's korban was accepted and his wasn't. And it landed up in murder, and there was no justification for it, whatever. For the whole argument, from the beginning, God didn't even accept any justification for the existence of an argument. Never mind for the act of murder, which was the culmination of that argument. Because that first category of machlokas has to be solved within you. That's your problem, not the other guy's problem. You have a problem. It's not even an interpersonal problem, it's a personal problem. If you don't like another person when that person has done nothing wrong, then you have a problem. It's not as if it's no problem. One can't brush it aside and say, forget about it. What did he do, so forget about it. You do have a problem. You don't like him. And there might be a reason you don't like him. Maybe you really don't like ginger hair and it really makes you mad to see it. But that's your problem. It's not his problem. It's not the rest of society's problem. It's maybe you and your psychiatrist's problem. That's it. And you've got to sort it out within yourself. If there's no reason for that dislike or for that feeling to ever receive any expression whatever. That one has to understand. There are certain emotions that have to be expressed, sometimes always. There are certain emotions that sometimes must be expressed. And there are certain emotions that must never be expressed. If you have a problem, it's none of nobody else's business. Unless that person wants to help you. It's your doctor or your lawyer or your psychologist or your rabbi, that's something else. But there's no reason for you to express and give vent to your problems, which is the dislike that you've taken to somebody else for no particular reason whatever, or certainly no reason of his fault. And that's 90% of all machlokas. The next machlokas we had is an interesting one. It's between who, would you say, is the next one? Abraham and Lot. Very good. In the beginning of Lech Lecha, Vayomer Avram, this is the business where the there was too little ground for the shepherds, and the shepherds started arguing with one another. Vayomer Avram el Lot, and Avram said to Lot, Al na tehi meriva b'ni v'enecha, let us not develop into an argument. Meriva is the term the Torah uses for this kind of argument. Uvein ro'ay uvein ro'echa, between your shepherds and my shepherds. Ki anashim achim anachnu, we're brothers. Halo chol ha'aretz lefanecha, the whole land is before you. Hipared na me'alai, please leave me alone. Im hasma'o v'eimina, v'im hayamin v'asmi'ila. If you turn left, I'll turn right, and if you turn right, I'll turn left. What argument is this? What kind of machlokes is this? The halachic argument, we're told, Rashi tells us, but the argument over there is as to whether the shepherds have the right to take their animals into the pastures belonging to other people. Avraham's shepherd said no, that's theft, and the other shepherd said no, but God has already given the land to Avraham, so why can't he take it over? The fact that we're still allowing those people to use our pastures doesn't matter, the land is ours. This is a halachic argument. This is no simple matter. Avraham heard the argument and paskened the way his shepherds saw the thing. Lot did not want to accept it, and Lot's shepherds didn't want to accept it. Avraham says, right, you can't accept my psak. You've got to separate. There's no way we can live together. And that's how one handles a halachic machlokes. When there's a dispute in halacha to the point that it makes or that it affects one's living together, you split. There's no way that you can have two halachic views being lived together, being expressed together, and certainly in a situation as was the situation in the case of Abraham and Lot, where Abraham was the rov of the community, and this was no small community. This wasn't just Abraham and Lot. This was Abraham and Lot and their secretaries and their shepherds and their accountants and their lawyers. It was a very big business and a very big community at the time. Abraham was certainly the rov. Lot is fully entitled to say, I don't accept your psak, but if you don't accept my psak, somewhere else, not here. And nevertheless, look at the way he says it, says Rashi. It says Rashi, Im hasmo v'ayamina, if you turn left, I'll turn right. Bechol asher teshev, wherever you'll choose to live, lo etrachek mimcha, I won't go very far from you, v'amod lecha lemagen v'la'azer. And I will remain ready for you at any time to shield you and to support you and protect you. And in the end, Lot actually had to call on his help on two occasions. First one was the case with the kings of Sodom, where Abraham went out to help. And the second one is the case where God, where Abraham actually pleads with God to save Sodom and ultimately at least to save Lot. That's a halachic machlokes. You separate only in as far as you need to separate in order to solve the halachic dispute. But not one bit further than that. Lot has refused to accept Abraham's psak. So what should Abraham say? Okay, fella, have nothing more to do with me. That's it. Go somewhere else. He says, no. He says, look, we can't live together because this is now affecting something serious. We have to set up separate communities. You be the rov in Sodom or wherever you want to go. You choose. And look what Abraham was, look at the risk Abraham was taking. Lot could have thought to himself, Sodom, I'm not going to go to Sodom. I'm going to go the other way. And Abraham would have landed up in Sodom. Abraham was prepared to take that risk because according to halacha there was no way he could live together with Lot, and if he was choosing to split the partnership then it's a din, it's halacha, that he has to give the other partner the opportunity to choose whichever section he wants. So Abraham came to a simple halachic conclusion, that I've got a split, once I've got a split, I've got to give him the choice. And even then Abraham says, on matters of common interest, when we stand against a common enemy, don't think I'm going to be far from you. I'll be right next to you. We'll run separate communities near each other, and we'll cooperate on any matter of common interest. And you see, in fact, that's how it works. That's how a halachic dispute has to be solved. And the next machlokes we have is in this week's Edra, between Yaakov and Lavan. Let's just see a little bit what goes on there, what kind of man Lavan is. Right from the beginning we get a picture of this Lavan. When Lavan heard the name of Yaakov, the son of his sister, he came out to meet him. Why, say Chazal? He thought to himself, if the slave came to fetch my sister last time, and he was so full of money and precious stones and all sorts of belongings, what's this man going to have? This is the master himself that's coming. Imagine what he's got. And he comes out, and he comes to meet him, and his face falls. No signs of trains of caravans and gold and silver. So he thinks maybe he's smuggling it, maybe it travels at customs and it's under his jacket or something. So he hugs him, feels around, also nothing. So then he thinks, well, there's only one thing, it's diamonds. He's put it into diamonds and he's got the diamonds in his mouth. So he kisses him. And all that doesn't work, so he comes to his house and he tells Lavan the whole story. In other words, say Chazal, he told him the whole story that he had this argument with Esav, and Esav took whatever money he did have once, and now he's got nothing. He's very sorry. So Lavan says, but you know, if even so, even without money, you're a relative, so you can stay with me for 1 month. He's told him he's running away from a brother who's after his life. He's got nowhere to go. He's got no money. Lavan says, 1 month you can stay. Six. After the month, Lavan comes to him and says, well, you can't go, and you wouldn't want to just sit around and take my charity for nothing. You sit and learn Torah and I support you. You wouldn't like that. So you would obviously want to work. But I also wouldn't like you to work for nothing. Just for your board and lodging. You're not a slave. What salary do you want? And the Torah goes into some detail about the two daughters and says that Yaakov loved Rachel, and he said, I'll work for you 7 years. There's a reason why he picked 7 years. He knew that was the time he had to be away from home for your daughter Rachel. So Lavan said, I'd rather give it to you than to someone else. It's a deal. And notice how Yaakov specifies it in the contract. I'll work 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Say Chazal, he says that. He gives her name, Rachel. And he says, it's your daughter, so that he shouldn't try and find some other Rachel. So Yaakov already at this stage knows who he's dealing with. He puts it in the contract. It's your daughter, Rachel. And he adds in, Haktana, the younger daughter. Don't try and change their names. And give me the older daughter. So he suspects at this time already that there's going to be trouble. But he thinks, a contract's a contract. Deal's a deal. I'm safe. And he works his 7 years, and it's nothing for him. It was like a short time because he loved her so much. There was no question of Lavan giving advance payment. The time comes. Yaakov goes and demands his salary. And Lavan gathers a whole meeting together. And a whole reception, which he prepares very carefully. And he brings Leah instead of Rachel. You know the story that Rachel and Yaakov, in anticipation of such a thing, had in fact made a secret sign that she would use under the chuppah so that he would know if he's getting the right one. As Rachel saw what was happening, she thought to herself, what's going to happen? My sister's going to go to the chuppah, she won't know the sign, and Yaakov's going to make a scene, and she's going to have to walk all the way back down the aisle in front of everybody. That's not nice. I'll give her the secret sign. So standing under the chuppah, Yaakov had no doubt. Leah gave the sign, and they obviously look fairly similar, certainly with a veil over their faces. The difference seems to have been in their eyes mainly. Yaakov marries the wrong woman. And he goes and he says, you've cheated me, Lavan. I worked 7 years for Rachel, and look what you've done. He says, you know, in our place, we wouldn't do such a thing to give the younger daughter. I thought during the 7 years, Leah would get married, and there would be no problem. But it's we're very firm over here, and we would never do such a thing as to give a younger daughter. You should know that. And I didn't cheat you. I thought you would take it for granted that that was Leah. Obviously, it wasn't Rachel. This is spent Sheva Brochas with Leah, and if you work for me another 7 years, I'll give you Rachel. So Yaakov doesn't even put up an argument. Agrees. Why doesn't he put up an argument? He probably won't win. He knows who he's dealing with. Business is business. So he spends the Sheva Brochas with Leah, and then he marries Rachel. And we're told, Vayavod imo od sheva shanim acherot. Then after marrying Rachel, he works a further 7 years. And Rashi says, amazing Rashi, od sheva shanim acherot. Why does it say another 7 years? And what is the addition of the word od? It's 10. And he worked 7 years for Rachel. We'll know that that's an additional 7 years. Says Rashi, quoting the Midrash, acherot hikishan lerishonot. It connects the second 7 years to the first 7 years. Ma rishonot be'emuna, af achronot be'emuna. Don't think that because he's already got Rachel, and because he was cheated into the second 7 years, and because he really didn't want it in the first place, that he worked any less assiduously during those second 7 years than he did during the first 7 years. And we're going to see soon how he worked for those 14 years. But the same as he worked the first ones be'emunah, you can imagine with what dedication he worked. First of all, because he was a tzaddik, and second of all, because he was working for Rachel, and he knew that he was going to get, and he knew that Lavan would find any little thing that Lavan could find in which Yaakov had not fulfilled the contract. He knew that Lavan would use to try and get out of the contract. So apart from his tzidkus, he had an ulterior motive as well to make sure that there was absolutely nothing wrong with his work. But even after he had married Rachel already, and Lavan has no hold over him except a contract which he was crooked into signing, nevertheless, he fulfills that contract be'emunah. He fulfills that contract with absolute dedication and seriousness. Even though that contract was agreed to with slyness and with cheating, it wasn't something that he willingly went into. And he could quite easily have found a heter for himself, why he doesn't have to take this too seriously, and he can sit and learn a little bit. And no, he made a deal with Lavan, 7 years for Rachel. He's got Rachel, he owes Lavan 7 years, and he gives Lavan the seven best years that he can possibly give him. We already see something here of how far Machlokes is allowed to go. This is now the third Machlokes. This is where the other guys are Rosha. We all know Lavan, and we read on Pesach in the Haggadah that Lavan was worse than Paro, because Paro only wanted to kill the men, and Lavan wanted to kill everyone. He wanted to uproot the whole family of Yaakov. He hated them so thoroughly. We see right through the way he handles what a Rosha he is. This is the hatred of a tzaddik for a Rosha. You can imagine what Yaakov felt for this man, for Lavan. And yet, a contract's a contract. One has to be very careful. Machlokes has a horrible tendency to cause confusion and start making one believe that one is justified in taking certain steps. One is justified in taking certain steps, but one has to be very careful that in time of Machlokes, just as in time of peace, the steps one is permitted to take are governed by halacha and not governed by your own feelings of hatred. And halacha does not allow you to take financial advantage of the Rasha, where it's against your agreement to do so. You have a contract with Lavan. If you didn't want the contract, don't go into the contract. Now you've got it, you stick to it. You can take steps to protect yourself, and we'll see in a moment that Yaakov does that. But you can't take steps to outdo the other guy. You can't cheat on the other guy, and you can't steal from the other guy, even though he's a Rasha, and even though he tricked you, and even though he's tricked you all along and he's done you out of whatever you could have had, you can't, once you've got a binding agreement with him, there's no way that that agreement can be tampered with. At the end of that 7 years, he again comes to Lavan. No, sorry, this time he doesn't come to Lavan. He notices now that... No, sorry, he does come to Lavan. He says, the 14 years are over now, tonight, Nashai, give me my wives, I want to go. Says Rashi, give me my wives. Eini rotze latzeit ki im birushut. I don't want to leave without your permission. It's polite, etheretz. Not even legal. There's not even a legal reason why after the 14 years he can't get up and go. There's nothing binding. He has no respect for Lavan. He owes him nothing at all. Etheretz. I don't want to go without saying goodbye to you and taking your permission, telling you my contract is over. Let's separate and let's go. Which he does. And Lavan says, no, this is ridiculous. You've been very good. You've been the best manager I've ever had. And only through you I've become wealthy. What do you want? Fix a salary and whatever you want you can have. And carry on working for me. So Yaakov makes this famous deal with him of the Atudim, where he'll keep any spotted sheep. And he says, basically, take out the spotted sheep now. Whatever spotted sheep exists in your flock at the moment, you take out now. Create a separate flock for them somewhere else. Leave me only with the white ones. And whatever only whatever spotted or colored ones are born in this white flock, from now on, that's what I'll take. So you'll never be able to suspect me of breeding them specially or of doing anything, because you've taken every colored one out. Nor will you ever be able to suspect me of theft, because you'll know whatever I've got, whatever is a colored one is by definition mine. That's what the contract is. In other words, he's trying to make a watertight contract this time. He's learned his lessons from Lavan before, and now he wants the kind of contract which inherently doesn't allow Lavan to cheat him. And this is it's a very clever contract from that point of view. That means that by definition, if a spotted sheep is found among the flock, it belongs to Yaakov and there's no argument about it. And then Yaakov takes steps to try and improve his lot, and he makes this little mottled wood thing, and he starts relying on a lot of siyata dishmaya, which he gets. There's no biological reason really for the bit of wood at the bottom of the trough to produce such a quantity of spotted sheep, but Chazal say it was a miracle, and Malachim came and they brought sheep over from Lavan's kraal and had them interbred with the white ones, and it was all the Ribbono Shel Olam who was interfering there. And Yaakov knew that it was the only way he had of making a bit of money, but a miracle doesn't happen unless you do something as well. So Yaakov did as much as you can possibly do. What's that? At least try and let the mother sheep see these spotted things all over the place. That's as much as a human being can do. Thereafter it's in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and it worked, and he comes out becoming very wealthy as a result of it. And the inevitable happens. The sons of Lavan start talking, and Yaakov picks it up. Yaakov's already taken everything that my father had, and look how big his flock has got, and my father's flock hasn't grown. It's the inevitable of any partnership. If it's successful, then the successful partner is accused of theft, and if it's unsuccessful, he's accused of negligence. That's how it is. Yaakov expects it, so he has his ears attuned, and the moment he hears that, and the moment he notices that Lavan isn't quite as friendly to him as he used to be, he decides it's time to go. And at that time, then, having decided, God comes to speak to him. You see, Michael, God only speaks to you after you've decided. First you've got to decide, it's time to go or it's not time to go. If you decide it's time to go and God speaks to you, as he did to Yaakov, then you know you're doing the right thing. If you decide it's time not to go and God speaks to you, then you also know you're doing the right thing. But if you decide it's time to go and God hasn't spoken to you, then you should start worrying. So Yaakov decides it's time to go, and immediately he's decided, Vayomer Hashem el Yaakov, Shuv el Eretz Avotecha, you're right, go home, and Malatecha, the Eyem, and I'll be with you. Has God promised you this yet? So how long ago did you decide? It's too long. I don't think he's planning anything. So give it another few days. And Yaakov calls Rachel and Leah, and he gives them a long story about why he thinks it's time to go. It's interesting to note, he doesn't say to them, you know, God said to me, it's time to go. This is the whole story of, you know, business is not so good anymore, and your father doesn't like us so much anymore, and I don't think there's much of a future for me here, etc., etc., etc. So it's to give them a bit of a feeling for what you're doing. You can't come to a wife and say, that's the halacha, that's the din, I heard so in the shir, and that's what we're doing from now on. Because wives don't take that kind of nonsense. It's got to be explained and put over and presented, and with a bit of background and a bit of feeling and a bit of understanding, and then a wife integrates it and she accepts it, and Yaakov goes out of his way. And more important than Yaakov going out of his way, the Torah goes out of its way, and you know how careful the Torah is with every letter, never mind every word, and how many pages of Gemara are written about an extra letter that the Torah uses. And the Torah goes out of its way to report exactly how Yaakov presented this to his sisters, to his wives. It says, after God has said, Shuv el eretz avotecha l'olamot adatecha ve'eyeh emach, go home and I will be with you. And what more clear directive could you be? Could you imagine any one of your wives, if you came, you said, God says we must go and he'll be with us? Are you going to question that? Nevertheless, that's not the way Yaakov puts it over. He says, Ro'eh anochi et pnei avichem, I see the face of your father. It's not like it used to be. And God has been with me, and you know how I've worked so hard for your father, and your father has cheated me, and he's switched my salaries around, and God has stopped him from doing me any serious harm. And then I said, if I'll take the spotted one as my salary, and God arranges that they all are born spotted, and if I say that the striped ones will be, or the mottled one will be my salary, they all come out mottled. And God has belittled your father's flock and he's increased mine. And I lifted up my eyes in a dream and I saw that the spotted ones were becoming more than the white ones. And an angel came to me in a dream. This is all not true. Where did this happen? An angel came to me in a dream and he said, Yaakov, Yaakov. And I said, Hineini. And he said, look up and see all the spotted ones. You can see what Lavan is doing to you. I'm God, etc., etc., and the one that you had relations with in such and such a situation, and you put up this plaque to me. Come, get out of this land and go home. Tan Rachel Leah and Rachel Leah answer, and I say, look, we've got nothing to do with our fathers anymore. He doesn't really like us that much anymore. Let's go. Whatever God tells you to do, let's go. Right? Pages of explanation as to how Yaakov puts over to them something which happened to him really virtually in a moment. And this time he goes without asking. Now he doesn't come to ask permission from Lavan. Why doesn't he ask permission from Lavan? Because he knows what will happen. He's already had experience. He tried it the Derech Eretz way and it didn't work. Now he tries it the other way. And now comes the important part. Lavan hears that Yaakov has left and chases. And he says, Yaakov, what did you steal away in the middle of the night? Did you come and told me? I would have made a farewell party for you. We would have had an orchestra there and dancing and singing. It would have been a happy occasion. Why do you have to steal away in the middle of the night? And also you steal my idols as well. Yaakov says, I don't know what you're talking about. Come and search. You'll find nothing. Lavan goes around and searches very carefully. Finds nothing. And then, Vayicha le Yaakov. At that point, Yaakov gets angry. Vayarev b'Lavan, and he has an argument. Really, same thing as a machlokes with Lavan. He picks on Lavan. Vayan Yaakov vayomer leLavan. Yaakov answers and he says to Lavan, Ma pishi ma chatati ki dalakta acharai. What's my sin and what have I done wrong that you've come chasing after me? And you've searched my whole house. Have you found anything that doesn't belong to you? And Chazal say, imagine spending over 20 years with your in-laws. Is it possible that when you leave you're not going to find a teaspoon slips into your case, a pillowcase, a serviette, something slips in after 20 years of living in the same household? Not so with Yaakov. After 20 years Lavan couldn't find one little thing that belonged to him. And that's what makes Yaakov angry. Just before we come to an analysis of this machlokes and this anger, there are two other machlokes that I want to point out. The one is a medrash on Noach, where the medrash talks about the fact that not only were those who oppressed killed in the flood, but also those who were oppressed. Right? Why? And Chazal explain, there's a Vilna Gaon on this, because the Midrash just says here, Mirov Ashukim, because they are so pressured and so oppressed, Yaziku, they shout out. And the Chazal tell us they shouted out, they swore at their oppressors. And for that they were killed in the flood. You don't have a right to do that. He has no right to oppress you. And you have a right to defend yourself, but you don't have a right to insult him. You don't have a right to swear at him, and you don't have a right to use bad language at him. You know what that means? You can be in the torture chamber. Somebody can be torturing you. Somebody can be twisting your arm behind your back. They can be burning your skin. You have a right to do what you can to save yourself. You have a right to do whatever you can to protect yourself. But you don't have a right to swear at him. Right? This is not Jews. This is in the time of Noah. Just ordinary people, humanity. And they are called, say Chazal, people who participated in the Riv. They were argumentative people. The Torah labels them as people who had a part in Machlokes because they argued back. That's the one Chazal that's important. The other one is a Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Yud. Gracious, the mouth of the earth, in other words, the earth's ability to open up in earthquake to swallow Korach, was created specifically for Korach. So it was something very intrinsic to the whole development of mankind. Says the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Vayakom Moshe vayelech el Datan v'Aviram, and Moshe gets up and goes to Datan v'Aviram. This is after there's been this argument. Moshe knows what it is. It's the most terrible argument, and it's an argument without basis and foundation, and it's a dangerous argument, and it's with some of the top people, and Moshe has tried to persuade them, and he's called them to his office. Moshe is the king of Israel, has called them to his office, and they've refused to come. So we're not coming anywhere near you. It's none of your business. And Moshe knows that this argument can't be solved, right? Because he knows also, as we know, that the mouth of the earth was created in the time of creation, and that this is the only way this is going to be solved. And it says, Vayakom Moshe vayelech el Datan v'Aviram. After all that, Moshe gets up and goes to Datan v'Aviram to try and solve the problem, to try and make peace. Omer Reish Lakish, says Reish Lakish, Mikan she'ein machzikin b'machlokes. From here you see that you're not permitted to allow, to tolerate machlokes. The Omar Rav, because Rav said, "Kol hamachzik b'machlokes over belav." Anybody who tolerates machlokes is being over. He is transgressing a negative commandment of the Torah. Every moment that he allows it, right? So, I don't know how many moments there are in a second, but there are at least 60 seconds in a minute, which means every minute that you are allowing a machlokes to take place, you're being over at least 60 averus. We're talking about how careful one has to be with tuna fish. Is it this kind of tuna fish or that kind of tuna fish? The worst that can happen is that you eat the wrong tuna fish and you're over a lav. And that's terribly, terribly serious. Because it's a chi of malchus and it needs tshuva. It's terribly serious to land up eating a tuna fish which is not kosher, or one which was cooked together with a pet's food. But here, every moment that you allow the machlokes to continue, every second you're being over on one lav, equally serious to eating the wrong tuna fish. Right? Just weigh them up. What we're dealing with over here. Shenema, what is the issu? Velo yiyek Korach ha'adato. There is a prohibition to be like Korach and his community. And that's an issu to midi. It applies continuously. The same as every moment that you're believing in God, every moment is a mitzvah. So every moment that you're tolerating a machlokes, you're being over an avera. And what do you see from this Gemara? What is called tolerating a machlokes? Anything less than a king of Israel going to try and solve the machlokes when he knows it's hopeless and he knows it can't work and he's tried everything already and the men have refused to come and see him and they've humiliated him and they've denied his authority and they've continuously gone ahead and he knows that the end is going to be that they're going to be swallowed because he's a Novi and he knows that this argument isn't going to be sorted out. Had he not gone and still tried to do it with Dothan Vaaviram, he would have been over the love. That would have been a transgression. That's what we mean about not tolerating a machlokes. That means if you're as great as Moshe, and you're as sure that you can't be effective in your peace efforts as he was, that means you know for sure that this machlokes can never be solved. Not to go and try and solve it, not wait for the opportunity, but actually go to them and try and solve the machlokes. To do anything less than that, you're over every moment of the time, and isur of lo tiyeh k'korach v'ach'adasa. That's a machlokes of... Sorry, there's just one more midrash I must now find. Tagi, Rabbi Yitzchak by Meron, Etani la Veshem, Rabbi Chanina by Yitzchak. Kap danutan shel avot, the law and the tanutan shel banim. We would rather have the anger of the fathers than the modesty of the sons. Kapi nutan shel avot, where's the case of the anger of the fathers, minayin, where does that come from? From Asad, Vayichal leYaakov, Vayirev belavan. And Yaakov was angry and he argued with Lavan, Vayal Yaakov Vayomer, and Yaakov answered and said, Lavan, Mapish I, Machata Tiki Dalakta, etc. What have I done wrong that you've chased after me? The Medrash then goes into a little a bit of explanation as to what Yaakov was saying. And then it says, V'lo'an v'natan shel banim, what is the modesty of the children? Mi David, that's David. Where David was running away from Shaul, and he meets Yehonatan, Shaul's son, Vayivrach David min Nayot b'Ramah, and David flees from Nayot in Ramah, Vayavo vayomer lifnei Yehonatan, and he comes and he says to Yehonatan, Ma asid, what have I done? Ma avoni, what is my sin? Ma chatati, what have I done wrong lifnei avicha, to your father? Ki mevakesh et nafshiri, he's trying to murder me. Can you tell me what I've done wrong? Says the Medrash, Mazkir Shfichut Damim, Befiyuso. He mentions murder in his appeasement. How does Lavan appease? We'll discuss that in a moment, what it means by his mentioning murder in his appeasement. Yaakov carries on. What have I done wrong that you've chased after me? Doesn't say that you're out to murder me, which he is. What have I done wrong that you're chasing after me? That you've come and you've searched through all my furniture. Have you found anything of yours in my among my things? For 20 years I've been with you. Your sheep and your goats have not gone lost. And I've not eaten any of your flock. All the time that he was a shepherd, I've not eaten any of your flock. I've never brought you an animal which has been killed by lions, by wolves. Anochi achatena, I've taken that loss. Miyadi tabakshena, you've claimed it from me. The wolf, the flock comes out and there's one missing, I've had to pay for it. You've never lost an animal because of me. Gnufti yom or gnufti laila. You've claimed from me whether it's been stolen in the daytime or it's been stolen in the nighttime. I've never had an excuse. That's the kind of boss he was. At every moment, I've had to watch for you. Hayiti vayom achalani chorev. I used to stand guard in the daytime and I used to be eaten, consumed by the dry heat. The kerach balaila and the ice at the night. So he never slept day and night. Yaakov, he's had it before, but before it was at least for Torah, now it's for Parnosa, because he's got to watch the flock. That's how it means when we talked about he's working be'emunah, he's working in a trustworthy manner. This is the way he worked. He used to stand up all day and he used to get parched by the heat, and he used to stand up all night and he used to get frozen by the ice. Vakidash nati me'anai, and sleep never came to my eyes. I worked for you 20 years, and he goes on. That's what we mean by the work. Asks the author of Slabotka, what did David do wrong? What's the difference between these two things? Both of them are saying, what did I do wrong that you've come after me? So David said that you're after me to murder me, and Yaakov didn't say that. What's the big difference? Says the author of Slabotka, a very important thing. David called Shaul a murderer. Because what is he saying? I did nothing and you're trying to kill me. That means you're a murderer. You think you're trying to kill me because I did you wrong. Well, I'm telling you, Yehonatan, that I've done your father no wrong, and he wants to murder me. That means it's another way of saying to Yehonatan, your father is a murderer. He's trying to kill people without any reason. That's not allowed. Shaul's after his life. Shaul will murder him at the first opportunity. Shaul wants to do everything to get David. They're enemies. It's a machloikis. But you don't have the right to call the other party a name. You don't have the right to call him a murderer, even if it's true. That's an insult, and you're not permitted to insult another person. Yaakov was careful. Yaakov is also having a machlokes. Yaakov is also having a problem, and it's worse because he's arguing with a rosha. Shaul, it was a halachic argument. It wasn't a rosha. With Yaakov, it's an argument with a rosha. Nevertheless, he's careful and he's praised for it. Ma pishu, ma chatati, what have I sinned that you've come running after me? I'm not saying you're a murderer. We all know you're a murderer. We all know what you're out to do and why you're chasing me, but I'm not going to insult you. That's against the din. Taking that one step further, another is the most important middle that there is. Modesty is classified by the Rambam and others as the most important quality that a human being can have. The Torah rates it higher. Is something which is rated lowest and is never tolerated. The Rambam says, at best you're permitted to feign anger, you're permitted to pretend to be angry, but you're never allowed to lose your temper. And here we've got a case where the Medrash says, rather the anger of Yaakov than the modesty of David. So Yaakov here finds himself in a position where it's Vayichal Yaakov, he gets angry, which is something which the Torah seldom tolerates, or rather never tolerates. Nevertheless, the Torah would rather the anger of Yaakov than the modesty of David, as great as modesty is and as bad as anger is, because in the anger of Yaakov at least there's not an insult. Whereas in all the modesty of David, there's a veiled insult. And that certainly not tolerate. It's an incredible medrash. And we see here halacha laying down the rules of conduct in cases of machlokes. You can do what you want to protect yourself, but you're not allowed to take one step to the detriment of your opponent. Not an insult, not a coarse word, not a hard word, nothing. And we would rather have an angry man who watches that, as much as we hate anger and despise anger, than a modest man, yet in his modesty outslips a nasty implication, never mind actually a nasty word. We don't allow that. And you see here clear definitions. So let's just summarize it. A machloek is where the other guy has done nothing wrong, that's your problem, and nobody should know about it at all. A machloek is in a matter of halacha, you split. You go your way, you go, I go my way, and we cooperate on matters of common interest. Where the guys are rosha, there you've got to keep far away from him. You don't cooperate with him on anything. If you do have to deal with him, you try and tie it up as tight as you can. But you're not allowed to harm him. You're not allowed to in any way be aggressive in your defense. Not even to the point of using your harsh words to him. Has a very beautiful passage where he discusses the chiyuv, the obligation sometimes to hate. Because what about that? After all, there are times when we have to hate. There's a chazal which says, "Mi shiro'e b'chaveiro shechata," if you see that your friend has sinned, mitzvah l'sanoto. There's a mitzvah to hate him. And you should also tattletale to his Rebbe. Tell his Rebbe what he's doing, and it's a mitzvah for his Rebbe also to hate him. So when do you employ this chiyuv of sima? Says the Baal HaTanya. This is very important. Hainu b'chaveiro b'torah. This is a chazal. That's talking only when it's your friend in Torah or mitzvahs. That means you're only permitted to hate another frum Jew. Right? Somebody who knows as much as he should know in order not to do what he did. Right? So it means a person who has learnt and has acted badly despite his learning. Furthermore, ukvar kiyem bo mitzvah tocheach tocheach et amitecha, and you have already fulfilled the mitzvah of killing him off. And after you're discussing the matter with him openly and discussing it and showing him that it's not right to do that, he casts you aside and continues to act in the way he did previously, only then are you permitted to hate him. But a man who is not your friend in Torah, that means he's not a frum Jew and can't be expected to know what you know. What's a joke, Lewis? What are you laughing at? Disturbs me. And he's not tied close to him, you don't have a sufficiently closely and close and intimate relationship with this person to be able to be mochiach him, to be able to rebuke him. It's about such a case that Hillel was talking when he said, you must be one of the students of Aharon, ohev shalom, loving peace, ohev et habriot, loving humanity, umakarvan l'Torah, and bring them closer to Torah. I'll explain it in a moment. And then he goes on. V'gam ha-mekurovim elav v'hochichem v'lo shavu me'avonoteihem. And also those who are close to you and you've already rebuked them. That means it's somebody who should know better. And you have a sufficiently intimate relationship with him to be able to rebuke him. And you did rebuke him. And he hasn't listened. which now puts him into the category of mitzvah l'sanota. Now you've got to hate him. She mitzvah l'sanota, it is a mitzvah to hate him, but mitzvah l'ahavan gamken. That doesn't cancel out the mitzvah of ahavta l'recha kamocha. Simultaneously, you have to love the man. And both are true and possible. The human being is capable of mixed and opposite feelings. You've got to love that which is good in him and hate that which is bad in him simultaneously. And most important of all, you should also arouse in your heart a feeling of sympathy. Because the combination of love and hatred for one man brings about sympathy. That means he's a man that you have feeling for, you love. And you hate him because he's doing something pathetic, he's doing something you shouldn't be doing. What is that? So you should feel sorry for him. Sympathetic. Mercy, sympathy outshines hatred and brings about love. Right? So the Bala Tanya here said something very important. There is a mitzvah to hate a person, but that's only after you've done your part of it. A, he's got to be a person capable of being hated. That means that he should know better and has the learning to know better. B, that you have the relationship with him to be able to correct him, and you have tried to and he's rejected it. Only then are you permitted to hate him, but you're expected to love him at the same time. That the hatred and the love must be together, and there must be a feeling of sympathy with that as well. Thanks. And the... the present Rebbe says in the name of his father-in-law a beautiful pshat on the pasuk in the Torah, which is new. None of the other mefarshim discuss various different pshatim because it's a difficult pasuk. Lo tisna'a et achicha bilvavecha. It says in Kedoshim, you mustn't hate your brother in your heart. Hocheach tochiach et amitecha. You must rebuke him. But lo tisa'a alav chet, and you won't be responsible for his sin. Rashi learns velotisa alav chet, meaning, but you mustn't be responsible for his sin. In other words, although you're expected to rebuke him, it must never be done in a way which might embarrass him. Because then you become the sinner, not him. That's the way Rashi learns it, and we pass from that way too. But the Rebbe learns the following. He says, lotisna et achicha bilvavecha. The condition to this mitzvah of hocheach tochiach is that when you do so, you don't bear any hatred to your brother in your heart. Which ties in with this piece of Tanya. That means before you're allowed to hate anybody, you've got to rebuke him. Therefore, you are only allowed to rebuke him if you don't hate him. If you don't hate him, you have no anti-feeling, no feeling of machlokes. You've seen him do wrong, and you feel quite objective about it, and not subjectively involved. Then, hocheach tochiach et amitecha. Then you must rebuke him, the lotisa alav chet, and then you won't find a continuation of his sin. In other words, his sin will stop. And as the Rebbe, and if his sin doesn't stop, it's a sign that you didn't fulfill the condition of lotisnat achicha bevavecha. It's a sign that there was a little bit of hatred in your heart. It wasn't dvorim hayotzi min halev. It wasn't things that really came out of your heart. Because dvorim hayotzi min halev, if they come out of the cart, nichnasim min halev, they go into the heart. And it's your fault, not his. So it comes out that it's very seldom in practice that you can afford to hate a person. Because you've got to have gone an awful long way before you can start feeling condescending or hateful towards any particular individual. The practical aspect over here is A, that whenever you're involved in a machlokes, make clear that you clarify which of the three it is. The first area of confusion which causes destructive interpersonal relationships is confusion about what kind of machlokes you're involved in. Clarify to yourself whether it's a machlokes of the first kind, which is only your problem, or whether it's a machlokes in halacha, or whether it's a machlokes because you consider the other guy to be a rosha. And then decide halachically how to handle it. If it's the first one, you don't express it, you handle it yourself. That's your problem. In other words, if you can't put your finger on something that guy's done wrong, then you can't handle it. Then you can't come out with it. You've got to handle it yourself. And if you can put your finger on something that guy's done wrong, right? Now this is no longer a machlokes in halacha, because you don't believe he believes it's right to do that. He insulted you. In public, in the street, he insulted you. Now, you don't believe that he thinks he's entitled to do that. So really, this is the third kind of machlokes. You consider him a rosha. You consider he's gone against the Torah. Now comes in this whole piece of Tanya. Okay. Then, you've got to make sure that you have a sufficiently close and intimate relationship to be able to be mochiach him, to be able to rebuke him. And he's got to be somebody who knows better. And if you don't have such a relationship, you're bound and you're obligated to create such a relationship. Having done so, you've got to tell him that when you're quite sure that you don't hate him for it, and you feel no personal grudge, you're only angry at the objective thing that he did, and you would have been as angry if he had done it to somebody else as you are at him having done it to yourself, then you have to go and you have to rebuke him. And then if he doesn't listen to you and won't apologize and withdraw from it, then you have to hate him and you also have to love him at the same time and feel sympathetic for him. But until you've gone through that whole process, you have no right to be forribled, and you have no basis for machlokes whatever. And if it's a machlokes in halacha, that means you come and he says, I believe I was fully entitled to do it, and you go through and you learn the dinim, and he's got a point and you've got a point, and you stood up and you disagree. Okay, no, nobody convinces nobody. You disagree and you continue to work together in any areas you can, but when it comes to this kind of problem, you each go your own way. The reason I speak about this right now is because our community, the whole Johannesburg community, and it's all over the world, it's not just here, but we're suffering the problem here, is going through a stage now of machlokes, the religious community. And you're going to find, willy-nilly, I think, that you're going to get involved in this machlokes. If you're at all involved in the frum community, as you should be. The first thing is to be careful that you analyze your involvement, and that you know exactly where you stand. Is it the problem yours? Is it a halachic disagreement? Or do you consider the other side to be rishoy? And we've now discussed the halachic steps that have to be taken in each of the three cases, and there are no other cases. But secondly, you'll find that tremendous confusion exists between the ba'alei machlokes, between those who are involved in the machlokes. You have cases where I, for example, was told by one of the groups, or the opinion was expressed by a member of one of the groups, that unless I start recommending children to the school of that group, I'm going to find myself blacklisted and excommunicated by that group. I tell you this for a reason that I'll tell you in a moment. You have cases where a man has been considered very highly by one of the groups. And this applies to all the groups, not one particular one. This type of thing, at some time over the past 5 or 10 years, has happened to all of them. Each religious group in this town has done the same sort of thing. Where they have a man working for them or associated with them who's considered absolutely wonderful and on top, and the moment he goes and he works for the other institution, blacklisted and excommunicated, and he's not allowed to daven before the Omud, and he's not allowed to give a shir, and he's not allowed to have anything to do with their children. What does it all mean? Where is it all going? And I tell you this because not because it's our business to worry about what they're doing. Let them do what they want. What we have to be careful is that we don't get drawn into it. And that we're able to define very clearly our responses to such situations, to such threats. There's an effort in the community now, to put it simply, to bring about a polarization where you declare what side you're on and finished. You've got to now make your decision. Are you Mizrahi, Yeshiva College, Bnei Akiva? Are you Lubavitch? Are you Kollel? Are you nothing? What are you? Let's come out with it clearly, and we must know where you stand. There's that kind of pressure and that kind of effort. And the extent to which people are going to achieve this is one bordering on blackmail, if not already on blackmail. As I say, that's their business. Let's not get involved in that. What I want to make sure is, number one, that doesn't arouse in you a feeling of total withdrawal. Remember Avraham and Lot. Okay, they believe that you've got to decide. You regard that that's righteous to do what they're doing? I don't think it's vicious. I think they're entitled to try it. You might be fools to fall for it, but they're entitled to try it. It's a machlokes in halacha. Is that the way you do things, or isn't it? It's not as if it's just being done casually. It's a question of a shitta. How do you do things? And remember Avraham. You work together in any area of common interest. And if you can't see eye to eye on a particular approach, that's fine for that approach. But that doesn't mean that one... I have nothing to do with them because look at what they did or look at what they said. Avraham didn't say that. Avraham said, I will always be near you, and at any moment you need me, I'm there and I'll help you. But we can't live together. And the second thing is that one's response to such a thing is not one which brings one into machlokes, which is ill-defined. And if you do decide to align yourself with one or other of the sides, or if you don't, whatever it is, that you have in clear perspective the way you view the various people involved. And if you identify with one of them, that's fine. But then understand, is your disagreement with the others one of halacha, or do you regard the others as rishoy? If you want to identify with the kollel, or with Lubavitch, or with the yeshiva, with anyone, does it mean that you regard all the others as rishoy? Or have you got an individual problem, a subjective problem, or is it a dispute in halacha? And there are ways to handle each of those, and it must be handled properly. And if you don't want to identify with them all, then you've got to be careful to take your clear stand as well, vis-a-vis all of them, and decide, do you regard them all as a bunch of rishoy? In which way, there's one way to handle it? Or is there really nothing they've done wrong, it's just your own hang-ups? In which case, there's another way to handle it? Or is there a difference in halacha? That's not the way you think things should be done. Okay, so then you've got to clarify how it is to be done. And the thing that I think should continue to be clear is the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, there's no institution or body in Johannesburg, certainly not, that's sufficiently perfect to be the epitome and ideal of what Torah should all be about. And therefore we should continue to view each situation and each demand on its own merits and for the individual concerned. For me it's no conflict to send my child to Lubavitch school for those years that Lubavitch school has a good teacher, and to take the child out and to put it in the Kollel school for those years that the Kollel has good teachers, or vice versa. For me it's no conflict to send one of my children to Lubavitch and another one of my children to the Kollel and another one to the Yeshiva College. I will send each one where I think they'll do best, and that's all I'm interested in. And if as a result of that I get blacklisted by the whole lot of them, I really couldn't care less, and I hope you feel the same. Not only in the matter of the schools, which is becoming quite an ugly scene in a sense in terms of the parental involvement, but also other issues. And please, don't allow this to blind and confuse your whole attitude to the existing communities. They all do an incredible amount of good work. They all have an incredibly large amount of good work to offer you. And provided you can clarify your objection or your response, and I think you'll find that it's one of halacha, it's one of rishus. Then you've got to know that the areas in which you disagree and you understand it clearly. If that doesn't bring about hatred, that doesn't bring about condescension, and that doesn't bring about an inability and an unwillingness to cooperate very closely in any areas where you can be of help to them or they can be of help to you.